to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Thank you for listening in. I am your host for today, Susan Franzen. Glad to be back in time to vote in yesterday's election and to announce the results this morning. It's at a time like this that we realize just how large our listening area is. I'll only announce the Ames votes because we have 13 city votes and we have 8 different school districts within Story County alone, not to mention our other 6 counties. So we do have some results that people are waiting to hear about. In fact, somebody called just before we went on the air to ask what the results were. So for the Ames City Council, we have 2 unopposed incumbents, Bronwyn Beatty Hansen and Tim Garten. And we did have a contest in the 4th Ward, and Rachel Junk won with 592 votes, Chris Nelson, 416, and Joe Van Edwick with 194. So that's a change in our city council. And the school board election, where we had 7 candidates and 4 seats. If you listened on Monday, you got to hear all of those candidates. The winners were Sabrina Shields-Cook, Alisa Franzen, Michelle Lincatis, and Alan Bierbaum. I will announce one particularly close race. The Cambridge City Council had only 80 votes, or 81, because Tricia Todd got 41 and Whitney Baxter got 40. So that's cliffhanger. And the other one is the school board in Nevada. I mentioned that because you'll recognize the names of the new council people, Martin Chitty, Leanne Harder, and Tom Meyer. Now that we have made that announcement, we have more than election news. As you may have heard, there was a rumor for the last month or so that the 4-H camp south of Boone was to be broken up into 12 parcels and sold to developers. Over the weekend, the announcement was made that it will remain in public ownership. The Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation spokesperson Joe Jajak explains this exciting development.
Well, today on Local Talk, we're visiting with Joe Jajak with the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation. Welcome, Joe.
Thanks, Pat. Nice to be here.
Yeah, this is a great day in the morning. I'm going to share with our listeners that there's a 1,000-acre holding south of Boone called the 4-H Camp. And we just learned over the weekend that the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation was able to purchase that property. Now, it had been divided up into 12 different sections. It looked like there would be a lot of moneyed interests would get involved and probably end up in private holding. But as a non-governmental organization that the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation provides, it's sounding like this area could be possibly available for the citizens of Iowa and all the world. Is that a pretty good assessment there, Joe?
Yeah, I think so, Pat. Like you said, it was listed for sale in late September, and they divided it into 12 parcels. Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation put in an offer on the entire piece. We were most concerned with keeping it whole. We think it has the most natural resource value as the entire tract, just for wildlife habitat, water quality, outdoor recreation, as a whole piece like that. And so we were fortunate that we could come to an agreement with the 4-H Foundation late last week, and we'll be closing on the sale hopefully in December sometime. Uh-huh. And I think you mentioned, what we're trying to figure out now is the most appropriate public use. We're talking with some of our public and private partners, including the Iowa DNR, about what the future of this property could look like. But in some way, people will still definitely be able to enjoy this camp, and that's what we're most excited about.
Well, what does this property look like? Could you please describe it there along the banks of the Des Moines River?
Yeah, well, it's a beautiful spot. like you said, it's right along the banks of the Des Moines River, south of Boone. There's a few other camps in that area, so people might be familiar with it. There's a scout camp across the river. The Y camp is not too far from there. And just a little farther up the river is Ledges State Park. But it's really hilly terrain, mostly covered by high-quality oak hickory woodlands, really well-managed woodlands there. It has a stream or a creek running on the east side of the property. On the west side, it's bordered by the river. You know, it has a lot of facilities that the campers have used over the decades. So there's a few little villages of cabins. There's a main dining lodge and some things like that. But it's really a beautiful natural area that has miles and miles of hiking trails, spots, hike-in camping spots, and a good-sized fishing pond. And it's a really special place.
Well, it sounds like it complements some other expanses of woodland forests when you mentioned the other camps. So why is it that scale is so important, in that scale meaning larger areas here in Iowa?
Yeah. You know, when it comes to habitat for wildlife, it's all about connectivity and having those corridors that animals can migrate through. And the more that it gets divided or fenced or separated, the harder it is for them to do that migration, to do that moving around that they need to be able to spread out a little bit and live in the natural way they do. You know, a property this size, it's really important to be able to keep it whole for having both kind of that migration corridor that a lot of animals use going up and down the river there, but also just a little room for animals that are there all year round to spread out and have more natural habitat there.
Yeah, I guess it's been shown where large expanses of habitat connected by the critical corridors, what we're attempting to recreate as far as the Iowa landscape. So this area is it's real important to the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation. How is it that your role is perceived with, you know, your partners with the, you mentioned governmental organizations like the DNR and non-governmental organizations? Could you please explain how Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation partners with these other agencies?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, INHF has been around since 1979, so this is our 40th anniversary this year.
Oh, congratulations.
Thanks, Pat. From the beginning, we've been able to play that role in public-private partnership. In that 40 years, we've been able to permanently protect more than 175,000 acres, and the vast majority of that is us being able to step in, you know, and purchase properties or accept donations of properties. And a lot of times that's working as an interim landowner or holder, and a lot of that land ends up going public, whether it's with the DNR, County Conservation Board, or a city that ends up holding it and using it as outdoor recreation space for people or wildlife habitat. And so we're fortunate to be able to have those partnerships with those both public and private organizations that make that conservation, that land protection possible.
Yeah, it's just fantastic. I think the mission that Jerry Schneff, your director in 1979, and of course how he worked so closely with Dwayne Sand and then Mark Akelson, and now Joe McGovern as your current director. And so in 40 years, it's been wonderful to realize all that the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation can provide the citizens of Iowa and all the great work that you do. Hey, but I'm kind of curious. So why is the 4-H camp important to you, Joe J. Jack?
Mm-hmm. Well, I had the opportunity to get up there a couple weeks ago and hike around a little bit. And, you know, I was never a 4-H'er, so I never went to camp there growing up. But this place has a real legacy with a lot of people around Iowa as a place where they went to learn about nature, a place where they went to connect with the outdoors. And when I had an opportunity to hike around, you can just feel that it's a special place. It's well managed. It's well taken care of. But it just has a sense of wildness to it as well. And I think part of that is due to its scale, its size. It gives it a sense of wildness that you don't get in a lot of other places in Iowa. So, you know, you can tell that this place is special to a lot of people that spent years and years going there as campers. But to me, it's really important to have places like this that are going to be available to future generations that are going to be able to get outdoors and enjoy that and learn a little bit more about our natural history. And so I'm just really excited that we were able to do this and that it's going to be protected forever and it'll be there for future generations to enjoy as well.
Yeah, I could hear the excitement in your voice, Joe. This, and I think it's proximity to the center of Iowa, its scale, the amount of acreage, how it ties in with the other non-governmental organizations like the Boy Scouts and the Iowa Arboretum and the other camps, the Ledges State Park. It really kind of is a key holding in an area that is a tremendous corridor and a tremendous flyway coming down through the center of Iowa. Thanks for sharing your thoughts. Is there anything else?
You know, I think we've heard from a lot of people that are really excited that INHF was able to do this project, and there's more to come. You know, we're going to invite people's ideas and feedback on what the future of this property can look like, and there's probably going to be some fundraising that goes along with that, you know, depending on what the plan is. And so we look forward to working with the community, working with our INHF members, and figuring out what this is going to look like. And we welcome anyone that has ideas or wants to get involved in helping out with this project. They can contact us at inhf.org or find us on the phone, too. And we're happy to talk.
Yeah, great. Keep me on speed dial, if you could, Joe.
We'll do, Pat.
As your work unfolds, as we can share your message, and it's just a humbling, such an exciting message that in the 21st century, we can make choices for the environment. And thank you to the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation.
And Larry Stone with the Clayton County Conservation Board shares some of his early memories of the 4-H camp.
Well, today we're talking about the 4-H camp just south of Boone, kind of southwest of Ames, with Larry Stone. And people may recognize Larry's name as the outdoor writer, feature writer for the Des Moines Register. And
a few years ago.
Yes. You're still contributing as an author, as a writer, from your home near Elkader, and that's in far northeast Iowa, in Clayton County. Welcome to Local Talk, Larry Stone.
Thanks, Pat. Glad to be here and excited about the 4-H camp.
And I guess I'm assuming that you have a history there, being it's been such a featured conservation destination over the years. Do you recall the first time you were ever visited that 4-H camp?
I think so. My memory is a little fuzzy back to 1961, but
oh my goodness!
I was a 4-H member when I in Warren County.
Oh, you grew up on a farm?
I grew up on a farm. Yeah, in Warren County, and the summer of 1961, there were several of us from Warren County went 4-H camp for few days. I'm not sure how long it was, but the one thing that I remember most about it was that we took a canoe trip on the Des Moines River, and I'm not positive if I'd ever been in a canoe before, but I do know that I enjoyed that trip, and I've ever since have enjoyed canoeing.
Yeah, I recall your feature of doing the full extent of the Des Moines River in 1994.
You got the date right.
Yeah?
It was supposed to be 93, but some people might remember there was a flood in 93, so we delayed it till 93.
Yeah, it wasn't good for canoeing in 93, but you were out there in 94. And as a Clayton County Conservation Board member, it sounds like canoeing is a pretty big part of your outdoor enjoyment.
Yeah, we canoe. We live adjacent to the Turkey River. We canoe the Turkey River as often as we can, weather and time permitting, and I've done canoeing all the Boundary Waters canoe areas and a number of Iowa rivers and other places in the country, too. So, yeah, we really, really enjoy canoeing, and I guess you could say the 4-H camp in 1961 might have got me started on it.
Well, and as I think of You know, there's a reservoir now, so things have changed somewhat on that floodplain of the 4-H camp. So it's 1,000 acres, or thereabouts, with quite an oak hickory and rugged terrain, and a lot of hiking.
Yeah,
and camping.
I'm sure we did some hiking when I was up there with the 4-H camp. You know, in mm-hmm. with a group of 4-H'ers in the 60s. But then subsequently, after I became outdoor writer at the Des Moines Register, I often would get to the 4-H camp to write about and photograph activities that were going on there. You know, everything from teacher workshops to, oh, probably forestry field days to students there for camps and activities. And it was a fascinating place, and you know, that rugged river valley and upland woodland terrain was fascinates me, still does.
Yeah, there's a lot of family camping. Were there ever any times that you and Margaret were able to take your children, Emily and Andy, out to that 4-H camp?
Well, as a matter of fact, it was a winter, I think they called it a family fun weekend or something like that at the 4-H camp that was sponsored by 4-H. And we went, Emily would have been probably about a year old, and Andy would have been probably five. And we had a great time. It was kind of cold. We slept in a kind of a cool, rustic cabin, but did such things as, oh, I think it was near Valentine's Day. The kids were making Valentines, and we had folk dancing, and Emily was riding in the backpack doing folk dancing. So it was a memorable experience, you know, as a family activity that we really enjoyed.
Sure. Well, as you were covering the different conferences and things occurring there at that 4-H Conservation Center, how critical is this sort of habitat to the Iowa landscape?
Well, this is major as far as having this type of wildlands. And, you know, you can't call the 4-H camp wilderness because there's trails and there's buildings and cabins and that. But it's protected land as far as, you know, I think there's some probably native prairies, restored prairies, savannas, woodlands, not only the Des Moines River, but some other creeks and ravines, and that sort of habitat in Iowa, where how many million acres of cropland do we have? 25 million acres or something like that. The river corridors, and especially this Des Moines River corridor, are really essential as far as preserving areas of habitat that, you know, corridors for animals and maybe even plants do, you know, exist in those corridors. So it's of major importance to our state.
Yeah, the raptor migration each spring and autumn, the neotropical migrant songbirds that have critical habitat and needs in that regard, bald eagle nesting, and there's also an area there where bald eagles need to get out of the winter extremes, and they'll have night roosts that. So with bald eagles, it's beyond just nesting. There's night roosting opportunities in those secluded valleys.
Yeah, we talk about bald eagles sort of routinely now, and these areas are critical for the recovery of the bald eagles. You know, 1961, when I was first there, people would have thought you were nuts if you.
Yeah. Yeah, it was beyond our wildest expectations to see a bald eagle in 1961.
Well, and probably things like wild turkeys, too. They're abundant in that area now, and they didn't really get established in Iowa until, I think it was into the 70s before they were really starting to boom in Iowa.
Sure. Yeah, river otters in their pond. With your close association with the Clayton County Conservation Board there in Alcater, How important is the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation to your mandate of providing public access areas to the citizens of Iowa?
Oh, they've been great partners. We had one of our major areas, the Motor Mill Historic Site, about 150 acres along the Turkey River with the Motor Mill, which was opened in 1870 as a grist mill, so it's going to be our 150th anniversary next year. The Natural Heritage Foundation helped us acquire that site beginning in 1983. So we also have another site that the Natural Heritage Foundation helped with. It's a bluff over in the Mississippi River Valley called Pleasant Ridge. I think it's about 80 acres, but they helped us acquire that as well within the last 4 or 5 years. So, and then not just in Clayton County, but in other counties as well, the Natural Heritage Foundation has a kind of a lower profile program where they help landowners.
Oh, sure.
Put conservation easements on their own private land. To keep it from being developed in the future. We have that on our small 100-acre timber here along the Turkey River, Clayton County, and there are probably hundreds of those around the state with individuals that the Natural Heritage Foundation has helped out with.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So essentially, it goes right with the title of the land that it'll remain in. Well, pretty much wildlife habitat.
Right, yeah, and there's, the easements are specifically designed for each piece of property, whether it be prairie or rivers or what sort of habitat, but they keep it undeveloped, and whether or not it has public access, it's important.
Well, but the habitat is protected.
Right, that's important.
Mm-hmm. This area we'll have camping opportunities, I'm presuming, because it's opportunities for people to go and recreate. Boy, what would it mean to the Stone family to take the grandkids out to an area that you experienced with your children back in the 80s?
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised, but what that will happen. We like to get out with the grandkids. Fishing, hunting, canoeing, hiking, and this will be just one more area that there will be that opportunity. So it's people from all over the, not just the Des Moines, Ames metro area, but all over the state. So I'm sure we'll get to the 4-H camp area that will be developed for public use. Yeah.
Yeah, this is a great day in the morning. This is a wonderful development. Is there anything else, Larry?
Well, I think that's it. I'm just so delighted to see the Natural Heritage Foundation take the lead and get this area protected for the future.
Yeah, well, thank you for all you do for conservation, Larry Stone, and best regards. Golly, this is it's sure nice to have an opportunity to talk with you about an area with such great potential of habitat base for songbirds and woodland mammals, but also as the corridor that'll provide critical habitat in that Des Moines River flyway.
It's an important acquisition and protection for the state.
In case you just tuned in, this is KHOI Community Radio, Story City, Ames, and the surrounding area. I'm your host for today, Susan Franzen, and you've been listening to Joe Jajak and Larry Stone talking about the good news that the 4-H camp south of Boone has been preserved for public use by the Natural Heritage Foundation. And I'd like to thank our nature reporter, Pat Schlarbaum, for bringing us those interviews. But Pat is right here in the studio with us this morning.
Yes, Susan, it's really a privilege to stop into your program and kind of shine a spotlight on a volunteer and with our engineer also, Paul Hertz, that Susan Franzen has contributed so much to this local talk team of KHOI. And we're appealing to our listeners. We're appealing to share this love for this station, what's in our hearts, and become members by going to our website, khoifm.org, and find that donate button. And weave yourself into some of these stories. I know you have literally hundreds of contacts that you have outreached to and brought to the studio. How does that make you feel when you go to the grocery store and people and you see people that you've had in your store?
Oh, well, when I go to the grocery store, the thing I love is to somebody say, I know your voice. You're on the radio. And I a listener I didn't even know.
Oh, Sue, yeah.
That's happened to me a couple times, and it's always, that really makes my day. So if you're listening to me and you hear me talking in the grocery store, or I was once at the cafe, and the woman who was selling the bread said, oh, I listened to you on the radio. It just made me feel so good.
Yeah. Well, Susan, you bring so much to the program. How did it feel when you, what can we go back to 2012?
Oh, I'd love to tell the story.
Okay. How did you get involved here?
Well, I was involved with Ursula and with Pat,
Oh, Paul Nelson.
No.
I'm Roger Parmenter.
Roger Parmenter. And, I mean, we worked together for years on getting grants ready and getting some of the background work, and it was very, very complicated.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, this is fine. I really hope this happens, but I never want to be on the radio. Uh-huh. And so when we were getting ready to go on the radio, Ursula sent me out to get interviews with all the mayors of the Story County towns. Just a little station ID. I'm the mayor of Story City, and this is, and then you get a 10-minute interview. And I said, well, I can't do interviews, but I knew Paul Wearson, who he definitely, Roger Parmenter had designated him as the voice of KHOI. And I had actually been with him when he did an interview with Kermit Miskell. And it was such a fabulous experience because he started, oh, yes, I went to school with your my older brother went to school with you. And they started talking about country schools and the bad things that the farm boys used to do and the pranks they used to play and the personal connection as well as being a very meaningful interview. And I thought, wow. But Paul said, well, I ran the station at Luther College when I was in college, but that was, two turntables and, I don't do this modern stuff. So I took my little field recorder with him and I pressed the buttons and I recorded his interviews. But what happened to me when I listened to these was I fell in love with these towns. Each town had a personality, and there was so much pride in the mayors. And I thought, I lived in Ames 50 years, and I never knew this world was out here. Yeah. And that's how I got hooked.
Yeah, and you share that so well. And is it our 7-county listening area?
Yes, stretching it a little, but we do. I've actually done interviews in all 7 counties. Oh, yeah. Not much in North Polk.
So if you're listening to Susan's story of her involvement here at KHOI, please consider this an opportunity to engage personally with your personal finances. As listeners, we really are encouraging you to go to our website, khoifm.org, and you can be included in the great work here that occurs at KHOI. And Susan, maybe I'll have a question later on.
Yeah, I think we need to move on to our next interview.
But I sure hope that people take this opportunity at this time. Just go to the website. We do have an open door policy here at 410 Douglas at the Ames Pantorium building. So stop in or go to the website, khoifm.org.
Thank you.
Thank you, Susan.
And do we have a little music?
Gonna take a sentimental journey.
I wanna go home.
Gonna set my heart at ease.
I wanna go home.
Gonna make a sentimental journey.
Back home.
To renew old memories.
I got my bag.
Got my bag. I got my reservation.
Spent my dough.
Spent each dime I could afford.
I wanna go home.
Like a child in wild anticipation.
Back home.
Long to hear that all aboard.
One of the things that we like to do on Local Talk is to present both sides of an issue. On Monday, we responded to the request from Shonda Burke from One Choice, Iowa, describing how she became convinced that mandatory vaccinations violated people's rights to determine their health choices. There is another side to that, which we are about to hear from Dr. Caitlin Padotti from the Department of Public Health. She is medical director and state epidemiologist and is on the line to tell us why mandatory vaccinations are considered necessary for public health. Hello, Dr. Padotti.
Hi, thanks for having me.
As I said, we have an open door policy. If people come and they want to present an issue, and she also had a conference to talk about, we welcome them. And if there is a controversy, we like to invite a follow-up. And that's why we called you. Do you think that she has a valid concern with the side effects?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a very important question. So, you know, parents really just want to do everything they can to make sure that their kids live long, happy, healthy lives, right? And so I think it's really important, especially when it comes to things related to health, to ask questions and to make sure that people understand why there's a given recommendation for something. And I appreciate that it can be sort of challenging because the decision for vaccinating can be sort of a complicated one. But I think having those conversations and asking those questions is so important. And that's why I would encourage anybody who does have specific questions or concerns to talk with their healthcare providers and public health professionals, because these are really the people who have some good insight and some expertise in this area and can offer that kind of support.
Thank you. And you, but I believe that having grown up myself, when polio was truly the terror of everybody in the summer, swimming pools were closed. I think everyone knew someone who'd had polio and was crippled. When the salk vaccine first became available, I remember a lot of people had bad side effects right away. I mean, they got sick afterwards, but I don't remember that it was ever mandatory that people get that. It was that because we all knew how awful polio was, people wanted to be vaccinated. Has there been a change so that people are now required to get vaccines?
Yeah, so again, I think that's a great question, and I think you bring up some really important context for how some of these really devastating diseases that used to sicken and kill many children in the United States and still do in other countries, you know, why we went through all of the challenges to come up with ways to make it so that those aren't problems for us anymore. You know, you mentioned polio, and, you know, my father grew up in a time when he was advised that he couldn't go to a swimming pool because of the risk of polio, and that's never been a concern I ever had, which is fantastic. That means that we had this great tool that was able to protect all of us so that I could grow up in a happier and healthier environment, which is exactly what we hope to do. And so I think keeping in mind that context and the understanding of the diseases that we're trying to prevent and the devastation and death that they can cause is really important. And when terms of sort of the decision to make those kinds of things mandatory, I can tell you that as we develop new ways to prevent these illnesses, there's a process that these things go through that typically takes many years, you know, maybe even a decade or longer, to make sure that we think that these vaccines are safe. And then once they've been adopted, there's still monitoring that goes on through something called the Vaccine Adverse Events Monitoring System in order to allow people, anybody, whether it's healthcare providers or the general public, to report any concerns they have so that we can get that information. So these are incredibly valuable, incredibly important preventive tools. They do have, you know, safety that goes into the safety monitoring that goes into the development, and even that continues once they're in use in the market.
Well, one of the things that I think that Shonda was talking about that I hadn't thought about was the vaccinations that babies get, the childhood diseases. And I remember, because all of those, except whooping cough. No, I think whooping cough was still a common childhood disease, and I understand a lot of children actually died from it. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. You know, whooping cough or pertussis is an example of an illness that if we don't keep people protected through things like the vaccine, it can get into communities and cause illness in vulnerable populations. And unfortunately, it can be devastating and kill babies. Babies don't have, you know, young kids don't have as much of an ability to protect their airway and to fight these kinds of things. And so it can be really devastating. You know, these kids will develop a serious cough and sometimes stop breathing.
But the one, I guess, that is now the most controversial, or I guess people are alarmed about, is measles. And that's another one that, now, measles was something you didn't want to get it when you were pregnant. I knew that.
No, absolutely. There's many things that we worry about with the measles virus. You're right, it can cause problems if for a developing baby, if you get it while you're pregnant. It can make some kids quite ill. In fact, some kids might get a brain inflammation and encephalitis or meningitis, you know, and quite rarely some will have long-lasting effects. There's also a syndrome associated with the measles virus that sometimes takes years, you know, a decade or more to develop, that can be quite serious and, again, affects the brain and can cause death. And in fact, there was some new research that was released from a couple of different groups last week that suggests that getting the measles virus might actually cause damage to your immune system overall and affect the way that it can fight other illnesses. And so for all those reasons, we recommend that the best way to ensure that you get to grow up and live a happy, healthy life is to make sure that you're protected against that virus using the vaccine.
Well, and the other concern that I think has been in the news recently has to do with epidemics. I mean, basically somebody coming into the country bringing a disease that hasn't been common here. And I think measles was the disease. Can you, I'm sure,
yes.
You know what I have learned about and forgotten.
No, you're exactly right. So unfortunately, this past year, the United States saw 1,250 cases of measles. That's far more cases than we've seen in decades, and certainly many more than we saw, you know, when we earned our elimination status back in 2000. To put that in perspective, the year before, in 2018, we had 372 cases, and the year before that, 120. And so you can see that that number has been climbing. And you're right, measles, again, is an example of an illness that still exists in other places in the world where they may not have as good access to this preventive tool as we do. And so what can happen is if you have somebody who's vulnerable, meaning somebody who is not vaccinated or is under vaccinated, and ends up being exposed in another place and then comes back and introduces that virus into a community that's not protected, it can move very quickly. And measles, unfortunately, is one of the most contagious viruses that we know of. It has a what we call a reproduction number of about 12 to 18, meaning that for every case of measles, there's about 12 to 18 people who will get sick because of it. And again, it's a concerning virus because of the health effects, the long-term consequences and even death that it can cause, and the fact that it can move very quickly if people are not protected.
So, is there anything that you'd like to say before we say goodbye?
Yeah, I would just like to thank you for having the conversation. And again, I would really encourage anybody who has questions or concerns or thoughts, please don't hesitate to reach out to your healthcare providers and public health. Again, we welcome those conversations, and we want to make sure that we're providing you with good, reliable information to help you make the best decision to keep your children happy and healthy.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your speaking with us this morning.
My pleasure.
That was Dr. Caitlin Pedotti. And this is KHOI Community Radio. And I see Pat over there looking at the microphone.
Yeah. Yeah, it's my role this morning to come in and assist all the good things that Susan Franson has provided the station here at KHOI 89.1 FM. We're embarking on our membership drive this autumn. It's a wonderful time when you listen to such a wonderful voice and such a wide array of guests. But thank you so much for the outreach that you provide this station and all the listeners here in our seven county area and across the internet. Susan, what is it that you look for in a topic, in a guest?
I really like to do good news stories. I'm glad that Dennis is on Mondays and Fridays so he can talk about the accidents and the fires and all the bad things that happen. Uh-huh. Because I like to talk about festivals, and I like to talk about interesting people and good things that are happening in the communities. Yes. New restaurants, new grocery stores. And as a matter of fact, a bad news story that I don't know how to deal with that really bothered me, because I've been to Ogden and I've seen that wonderful grocery store. Paul and I talk about the anchor institutions, the schools, the churches, and where possible, the grocery stores.
Grocery
and
store.
That was a wonderful old grocery store, the one that burned to the ground. And it was just horrifying to me to mm-hmm. think, what a hole.
Yeah, quite a shock. I'm sure there will be growth and new development and a new store, hopefully.
Hopefully.
Well, and I'm sure you'll cover that.
Well, we'll be watching it. But the other thing is that I don't know whether our listeners get as much of this as I do. I mean, I get so much more out of this than I think any listener does. The connections I feel with the theater groups, for example. Mm-hmm. I love the theater groups. And the festivals. And, I never was in Maxwell until I went down to their festival this year. Yeah. And, wow!
Yeah. And if you can hear the sincerity in Susan's voice, if you're listening at this time, if these type of stories mean something to you, you can get on the phone. You can always call. The number here is 292-2878. But we really encourage you to go to the website, khoifm.org. Find the donate button. Become a member. This is a call to action. So if the guests that Susan brings to this station are meaningful to you, share that appreciation and go to the website, yes. khoifm.org.
Yes, and this is the engineer here, Paul Hertz, jumping in, just offering my appreciation for Susan as well. I'm a generation or more older than both Pat and Susan, but Susan and handful of others in her closer to her age cohort really got KHOI going and were doing things quite a bit well before I got involved, and it's really nice at KHOI to see all different ages interacting and to have all sorts of different kinds of programming. We're not just local talk, we're music programs, which is more my area, and all sorts of other things. I would encourage our listeners, all of you out there, to become a member of KHOI, help support KHOI. This is the way we stay on there. We don't do commercials. We don't have a big foundation supporting us. We don't have a college supporting us. It's you, the listeners, that make it possible. So please go to our website, khoifm.org, and become a member. $60 is a membership. There's donate as much as you can, as much as you feel you value our station. khoifm.org. And yes, please call as well, 515-292-2878. Call in just like that very unexpected, and it happens now and again, these unexpected moments when someone called in 10 minutes before the show to find out what the election.
Right. He didn't offer us any money, though. So if you're...
yes. Please call and become a member this time.
Okay. And now that we're saying thank yous to people, I believe that our regular listeners know that my usual co-host is Paul Wearson, and you're probably missing him with his really marvelous voice. And he is unable to come today for a very interesting reason, but he can be available on the phone, and Paul Hertz is calling Paul Wearson right now. He couldn't be here this morning, but I love the reason that he's not here, which is that he has, since he's not on the phone, I'll tell the story. Yeah. He's not here because in Roland's Story area, they identify all the senior citizens, and they do special things for them. They have a Christmas dinner at Roland. I've actually attended that with Paul. It's served by the students with entertainment. In the fall, they organize students to go out and clean up the yards of all the seniors in that area.
Isn't that fantastic?
Yes, and today is Paul's day, so he's not going to miss that. Paul, are you on the phone?
I'm right here, yes, from my farm.
On your farm, yes. And I told the story about how you, why you're not here today, how you're waiting for the students to arrive. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm an old codger now, so the students, it's really nice at Roland Story, they come out and help elderly people with their yard work. It's a day reserved where they send out 10 or 15 groups of kids. I'll probably have 10 here, you know. And they're going to help me do all the end-of-the-season things out here. So they also do a big veterans program on November 11th and a huge Christmas dinner for seniors that the middle school puts on. Both those programs are at the middle school, so kids really get a chance to help us old codgers. Well, that's a nice program.
Well, it makes you wish to... When younger people are raking their lawns, you know, if you live in the Roland Story School District, you can look forward to becoming an old codger.
Yep, they treat us very well.
Well, as I believe that if you were here today, you'd be talking about the Story Festival. Is that coming up?
Right. It's an annual thing here at Story City. It's a natural, you know, the storytelling festival at Story City. And this year, we've got Will Stuck, who is our star storyteller, and he is a librarian who's grown into a professional storyteller. He really got acquainted with it when he did the children's programs at the library, and then he found out he could expand into adult storytelling. Now, you know, the Des Moines Register now features all the storytellers they have down there, and they always have a theme, you know, growing up or embarrassing things or whatever, so I think people are much more aware of storytelling than they were when we first started the festival. So storytelling is really not just a performance, but also personal sharing. And that's what most of the storytellers you see featured in the Register are. But in this case, we have people like, and myself, I'm a semi-pro at that, people who are learned about telling stories and can help other people be storytellers. And what we're going to do on Thursday, and this is what I always like, we begin the festival by being in the Roland Story Schools, and we have the storyteller, Will Stuck, coming to the elementary school and the middle school and the high school on Friday, or on Thursday, I should say. And this is really fun to watch because I remember a few years ago, the storyteller came to do the high school, you know. And all the high school kids come in so surly, you know, oh, no, another assembly. And they march in there like it's a duty. Well, this guy had them rolling in the aisles in 5 minutes, and they were just enthusiastic. So it's fun to watch storytellers work at the schools, from elementary all the way through high school. Friday is an all-dayer here. We have Will Stuck again. There's an improv workshop. There should be a lot of activities also around town. And then 6:30 in the evening, we'll have Will Stuck, of course. That'll be at the high school. We also have some vocal groups performing from the high school. And Roland Story has an excellent vocal music program. Only Johnston High School had more kids selected for the Allstate Choir this year than we did. So we have 18 going to the Allstate Choir. So we'll have some of those outstanding people, plus a one-act play put on by the high school folks, too. Now, Saturday, that's the big day for the festival. We begin on Saturday morning at 10 o'clock. Story stops. Those are businesses in town, and those business people are able to tell the story, not only of their business, but the history of that building. And Will Stuck will actually do a workshop at 10:30, and that's where he is available to train people in how to tell their stories. And the majority of people who do storytelling already tell stories of their life and their own experience. We also have, since this is library-sponsored, and actually the whole weekend features an opportunity for fundraising for the library, because we're planning to expand and acquire the business next door to the Bertha Bartlett Library. So we're in the process of making that happen. And in the afternoon, I'll be involved in that. It's the local lore at the library, people from the area who are telling their stories. And then Saturday evening is the biggie, 6:30. And we're going to be at the community center. And we have Fran Kinney is an interesting person. She's the daughter of Bertha Bartlett, who was a military wife and lived all over the world. And she was also president of Jacksonville University. Like her mother, who was such a founder in Story City of the library, she has been in the forefront of all the things that happen in Story City with regard to the library. In fact, one of the wings is named after Fran Kinney. She's 102 years old in Florida. We're going to Skype her in so she can talk and tell stories. And actually, she's a celebrity. Her autobiography, the cover, is Bob Hope kissing her on one cheek and Jack Benny on the other. So Fran Kinney is a celebrity in her own right and 102 years old. Then we're going to have one of our favorite sons, Eric Hansen, who's the morning anchor at KCCI. And he'll be featured at 6:30 on Saturday night, too. And he, of course, is well known as a winner of many Edward R. Murrow Awards for This Is Iowa, his series that he presents. And the main feature is also Will Stuck.
Thank you. This is KHOI Community Radio. Other voices you heard are Joe Jajak, Larry Stone, Dr. Caitlin Pedotic, and Paul Wearson. You can listen to today's local talk show and any of our past local talk shows on our website, khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Paul Hertz. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.
Funding for KHOI is provided in part by Iowa State Center, presenting Ailey 2 at C.Y. Stevens, merging the spirit and energy of young dance talent with the passion and creative vision of emerging choreographers. November 13th at 7:30 p.m. More information can be found at center@iastate.edu.